You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible, 14 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 4, given in Breslau on the 3rd of February, 1912, entitled Anthroposophy, Conscience, and Wonder. It might be beneficial, as we can meet so rarely, to touch on questions relating to the way in which anthroposophy directly affects life. The question often arises among anthroposophists, how does anthroposophy relate to those not yet in a position to see into the spiritual world clairvoyantly? Basically, such spiritual scientific content is received from communication obtained, shared, and based on research by clairvoyant consciousness. At this point, it must be emphasized yet again that all the facts and correlations stemming from clairvoyant knowledge, which are researched and communicated, must be understood with healthy common sense. For when matters that have been located through clairvoyance are present, they can be grasped and understood with the logic naturally embedded in human beings, but only if judgment remains sufficiently free of preconceptions for the duration. It can further be asked, is there nothing, are there not certain facts in normal human life, certain experiences of this normal human life, that from the outset point to the claim by spiritual research that underlying our physical world and all its manifest phenomena, there is a spiritual world? Now, there are many such specifics in everyday life, of which it can be said that human beings will never comprehend them, though they are obliged to accept them, if they have heard nothing about the existence of a spiritual world. Today, we would like to begin our observations by pointing to two facts relating to mundane, normal human consciousness in everyday life, which must be inexplicable where people do not take the presence of a spiritual world into account. Two specifics known to us from everyday life will be used, as they are not generally put under the right spotlight. Were we to do this now and then, the need for a materialistic world outlook would not be necessitated. Let's bring one of the two facts before our souls as follows, and it will connect with well-known events of normal life. If someone is faced with a statement or situation they cannot explain, using concepts they had hitherto acquired, they will be plunged into bemusement. In fact, taking the concrete example of someone seeing a car or a train for the first time, something no longer the case even in, say, deepest Africa, they will be extremely amazed. Their thoughts might go like this. After all I have so far encountered, it seems impossible for something to tear across the earth without being pulled. And yet I see it, and it is not being pulled. That's astounding. What someone doesn't yet know elicits amazement. What they do know no longer causes astonishment. Only things with which no connection can be made with prior experience causes bemusement. Let us keep this everyday example in mind. Now, we can connect this with another fact, which is quite remarkable. In everyday life, humans are faced with all sorts of things with which they are unfamiliar, but which they accept without bafflement. There are numerous examples of this. What is happening here? It would certainly be highly astonishing if, for example, someone sitting quietly in the normal run of things in their armchair were to be whisked up the chimney and find themselves flying through the air. That would indeed be bewildering. Yet if that happened in a dream, they would be participating without a qualm. We experience even more bizarre things in dreams which fail to baffle us, despite being incapable of connection with daily events. In waking life, we are indeed surprised if someone jumps inordinately high, yet when dreaming, we can fly and are not shocked. The fact is that in waking life, we can be shocked by things as yet unexperienced, whilst dreaming causes no such astonishment. This second fact, toward which we are turning our attention by way of introduction, is a question about conscience. In the course of doing human deeds, and in sensitive individuals this may include thoughts, something stirs in us that we call conscience. Conscience is actually independent of what those outer deeds may signify. We could, for instance, have done something that might have been very useful to us, and yet our conscience judges that deed. When conscience stirs, everyone feels that into the judgment of a deed, something else flows, an element that has nothing to do with its usefulness. It is like a voice speaking within us. You should have done this, or you shouldn't have done that. We are confronted with the fact of a conscience, and we know how strong this cautionary power of conscience can be, how it can follow us through life. We know also that the presence of a conscience cannot be denied. Let us return to the fact of dreams. How we do the most extraordinary things there, which, were we awake, would cause us the most frightful pangs of conscience. Everyone will be able to confirm from their own experience that they do things in their dreams without the slightest stirring of conscience, things which would make their conscience shout out were they awake. So these two facts, that of astonishment or bewilderment, and that of conscience, are strangely enough switched off in dreaming. Things such as this generally go unnoticed in normal life, and yet they illuminate deep into the substrata of our existence. In order to shed some light on these aspects, I would like to point to another fact, one that relates less to conscience than to astonishment. In ancient Greece, a saying was current that all philosophy stemmed from wonder, from awe. The feeling contained in this sentence, and by this I mean the feeling those ancient Greeks felt about it, is not to be found further back in Greek evolution, and only appears from a certain point onward in the history of philosophy. This is because those in greater antiquity did not yet feel in the same way. Where does the idea come from, precisely in ancient Greece, from a certain time onward, to state that we are amazed? Well, we have just seen that we are astonished by things that do not fit into what we have hitherto known. If we are bemused by the surprises in everyday life, this contains nothing special, nothing much more than an amazement at something extraordinary. Those surprised by cars or trains are merely in awe of something not yet witnessed, and their amazement is no more than wonder at something extraordinary. Far more astonishing than surprise at seeing cars or trains, or the wonder at what is non-usual, is the fact that human beings can also start to wonder at what is usual. For example, to be astounded by the fact that the sun rises each morning. People with everyday consciousness accustomed to this fact are not amazed by such phenomena. But when amazement is elicited over the everyday occurrences one is accustomed to seeing, this is the genesis of philosophy and knowledge. Those richer in knowledge are the ones who can experience awe and wonder at the ordinary things conventional people take for granted. Only at this stage does one become a person striving after knowledge. And it is for this reason that the ancient Greeks coined the phrase, philosophy begins in wonder. Thaumatzein. How do things stand with conscience? Again, it is interesting that the word conscience, obviously the concept, because the word only crops up once a concept has arisen, can be found in ancient Greece, but only after a certain point in time. There is no likelihood that you will find a word that could be translated as conscience in even older literature from roughly around the time of Aeschylus. By contrast, one such word is present in the literature of the younger Greek playwrights and poets, such as Euripides. With this, one can almost pinpoint that just as with wonder at what is familiar, conscience is also something of which human beings were only aware from a certain point in ancient Greece onward. From that point onward, what became the stirrings of conscience was, for the Greeks of ancient times, something quite different. In times of more remote antiquity, pangs of conscience were unknown to those doing something wrong. Then, people had a primal, elementary clairvoyance, and were we to go back to shortly before the Christian era, we would find that everyone still had this primal clairvoyance. If a person did something wrong, they would not suffer pangs of conscience. Instead, their primal vision would see a demonic figure, which would torment them, and such figures they called Erinyes, or Furies. Only once humans had lost their faculty of primal vision to see these Furies did they gain the capacity, when doing wrong, to feel conscience as an inner experience. We should ask ourselves what such facts show us and what is actually going on with everyday givens, such as wonder. For instance, were an individual from a remote, indigenous setting to experience being transposed into a city full of speeding cars and trains, their initial astonishment assumes that something enters their life that was not previously present, or which they had previously pictured differently. If more widely experienced people feel the urge to clarify many things for themselves, to delve into everyday phenomena, because they are able to feel wonder, this also assumes that they previously saw things differently. Nobody would come to a different conclusion about a sunrise from one based on visual appearances of the sun rising, did their soul not contain a sense that they had previously viewed it differently. Some might contend that we have been seeing sunrises since earliest childhood. So is it not idiotic when we educe wonder at it? There is no other explanation for this than to say, if we nevertheless feel wonder at a sunrise, we have experienced it differently, in conditions other than today's, in this life. For if spiritual science tells us that between birth and a previous life, we existed in a different state, we have, in the fact of wonder at such an everyday occurrence as the usualness of a sunrise, nothing other than an indication of that previous condition in which we perceived a sunrise, although in that state, it was without physical sense organs. We perceived all this with spiritual eyes and with spiritual ears. At that moment, people felt dimly, you are standing in the light of the rising sun, by the roaring sea, by burgeoning plants, and you are astounded. At this very moment, within the wonder lies the knowledge that you once perceived this differently than you do with physical eyes. It was with spiritual organs that we perceived this, before we descended into the physical world. Dimly, we feel that it looked different when we saw it before. This was, and can only be, before birth. A fact such as this requires us to recognize that knowledge would not be at all possible had human beings not stepped down from a previous suprasensory existence into this life. There would otherwise be no explanation for wonder and the knowledge contingent upon it. Of course, people do not remember in clear concepts what they experienced differently in their pre-birth life, but even if this is not clear in thought, it nevertheless arises in feeling. Only through initiation can it be brought with one in the form of a clear memory. Let us go into the fact that we are not amazed in dreams. The first question to answer is, what exactly is a dream? A dream is an ancient fragment inherited from previous incarnations, from a time when human beings in earlier lives experienced different states of consciousness of a clairvoyant nature. In the further course of evolution, however, this ability to look into soul spiritual worlds was lost. It was a twilight clairvoyance, and its evolution began earlier with a dim vision that led gradually to the clear waking consciousness of today. This, in turn, could develop in the physical world to the point that, once fully unfolded, it could again ascend into soul spiritual realms, but now with capacities which the I, capital, could gain through wakeful consciousness. What had human beings won long ago through ancient clairvoyance? Something of that gain persists as dreams. A dream is distinguishable from archaic clairvoyance in that it is experienced by a modern person, when it was developed a consciousness containing the drive toward knowledge. Dreams, being remnants of an earlier clairvoyance, do not contain this urge for knowledge, and it is for this reason that people experience the difference between wakeful consciousness and dream consciousness. However, what was not contained in the old dim clairvoyance, wonder, awe, can similarly not enter dream consciousness nowadays. Wonder and amazement cannot find entry into dreams, yet they are present in waking consciousness when we turn toward the external world. When dreaming, humans are not in the outer world. Dreaming is a translocation into the spiritual world, where things of the outer world do not pertain and are not experienced. It is precisely in their connection with the outer world that human beings have learned wonderment. While dreaming, they just accept everything that approaches them, as they did when they still had their dim clairvoyance. In those days, they could simply accept everything, because spiritual figures would come and show them what they had done in terms of good or evil. For this reason, humans had no need of wonder. In this way, dreams show us, purely through being constituted as they are, that they are an inherited remnant of ancient times, times when there was no amazement at commonplace things, and conscience did not as yet exist. We are now at the point when we ask ourselves why it was necessary for humans, who were at that time clairvoyant, not to remain so. For what reason did humans descend? Did the gods senselessly banish them down here? Actually, it is the case that human beings would never have achieved what is inherent in wonder, nor what is inherent in conscience, had they not descended as described. This descent was in order to gain knowledge and conscience, because they can only be acquired by being separated from spirit worlds for a while. Human beings have been acquiring knowledge and conscience down here to enable them to re-ascend, but now together with them. Spiritual science shows us how between death and a new birth, human beings spend a certain time span in a purely spiritual world. Immediately after death, we undergo a time of Kamaloka, the condition in which we tarry in a soul region for the cleansing of cravings, in a place, as it were, half in the spiritual world, where human beings look back upon their instincts and sympathies, still attracted through them to what bound them to the physical world. Only when this time of Kamaloka has been expunged can they experience a purely spiritual life, or Devakan. What does the human being experience when they step into this purely spiritual world? How does each person experience this? Even normal, everyday intellectual consideration shows that the regions between death and another birth must look quite different from our physical environs here. Here we see colors because we have eyes. We hear sounds because we have ears. But when, in a life beyond death, in spiritual existence, we have no eyes and ears, we can no longer perceive these colors and sounds. Even down here we see and hear less well, or not at all, if we do not possess good eyes and ears. To anyone who thinks about this a little while, that will be obvious. Evidently, we need to imagine the spiritual world differently from this world in which we live between birth and death. How the world has to change when we step through the gate of death can be imagined if we make a small comparison. Let us imagine that someone sees a lamb and a wolf. That person can perceive the lamb and the wolf with all the organs of perception available to them in physical life. They see the lamb as a material lamb and the wolf as a material wolf. They can also recognize other lambs and wolves and call them respectively lambs and wolves. They have a conceptual image both of lamb and wolf. One could say, and indeed one does say, that this conceptual image of animals is not visible. It exists within the animal. One does not materially see the nature of lamb nor wolf. One forms concepts of the being of lamb and wolf, yet the being of the animal is invisible. There are theoreticians of the view that the concepts we form of wolf and lamb only exist within ourselves and have nothing to do with wolves or lambs per se. Anyone who maintains this should be required to feed a wolf with lambs for as long as it takes until it has been scientifically proven that the wolf and every particle of its body now consists entirely of lamb substance. Then they would see whether a wolf has been transformed into a lamb. If it should transpire that the wolf has not become a lamb, then it will have been proved that the concept wolf, in quotes, can be distinguished from a material wolf, and that the conceptual wolf transcends its material counterpart. This invisible element, only created as a concept in normal life, is visible after death. Neither the white color of the lamb nor the sound it emits are audible there, but what is perceptible is the invisible principle governing the lamb, which is just as real and is present for those living in the spiritual world. Coexisting within the same space occupied by the lamb is a genuine spirit element which is visible after death. It is the same with all phenomena of the physical environment. The sun is seen differently, the moon differently, everything is seen differently. We bring something of this with us when we enter a new existence at birth. When we are seized by the experience that we have seen this quite differently before, then, amid the wonder and amazement, knowledge descends. It is something different when one observes the actions of a person. Conscience is then added. If we want to know what that is, we need to turn our attention to a fact that is verifiable, even without having developed clairvoyance. We need to focus on the moment of falling asleep. One can learn to do this without any exceptional vision, and anyone can experience it for themselves. When you are just on the point of falling asleep, things lose their sharp contours, colors fade, sounds not only become fainter, but it is as if they recede, moving far off. As if from great distances do they seem to sound, growing ever fainter, receding and appearing as if a mist were being thrown across them. Limbs become heavier. They feel unlike their condition when awake. They seem to have a weight of their own. Were one to take account of this during waking hours, one ought really to sense that when walking or lifting one's hand, they are weightless. Why does my hand seem weightless? Because it belongs to my body. Now imagine that you were carrying 100 weight in each hand. Why do we feel this as a heavy weight? My hand belongs to me so that I do not feel its weight. But the 100 weights are external to me, and because they are not part of me, I feel their weight. Imagine a Martian landing on Earth without prior knowledge of conditions here, and the first thing they would see was a person holding a weight in each hand. That Martian would initially be of the view that the weights were an integral part of the human hand and overall form. If they later had to accept the concept that humans distinguish between weight and hand, they would be astounded. It really is the case that we only experience as heavy what is external to us. When people falling asleep experience their limbs as heavy, it is a sign that the person is leaving their body, is exiting their corporeal body. We now take into account a delicate observation relating to the moment when feeling the heaviness of falling asleep. It consists of a strange feeling that speaks to us. You did this. You neglected to do that. The deeds of the past day flow past like a living conscience. And where they contain something we cannot endorse, then we toss and turn in our beds and cannot fall asleep. If, on the other hand, we can be content with what we have done, a blessed moment occurs when falling asleep, causing us to say to ourselves, "Oh, would that this moment could continue forever." Then follows a jolt, and this is the moment we step out of our physical and etheric bodies and are in the spiritual world. Let's focus on the moment when we experience a living conscience arising. Not having the strength to do anything sensible, a person tosses and turns in their bed. This unhealthy state prevents them from falling asleep. This happens at the very moment when they are about to leave the physical plane behind to enter another world, which, however, does not want to receive what we call a bad conscience. We cannot fall asleep because the world into which we ought to enter during sleep rejects us. This is why the exhortation to do deeds in harmony with your conscience is nothing less than having a premonition of the sort of human being we ought to be in future, a person capable of entering the spiritual world. If in wonder we encounter an expression of something we have seen earlier, so conscience is a manifestation of our future ability to see in the spiritual world. Conscience is an indicator as to whether we will shrink in horror or whether we will feel blessed when we are eventually able to evaluate our deeds in Devakan. Conscience is a prophetic preview of the way in which we will view our deeds after death. Amazement and the desire for knowledge on the one hand, and conscience on the other, are living signs of the spiritual world. These phenomena cannot be explained unless the spiritual world is included in the explanation. The person who can experience world realities in reverence will be more inclined to become an anthroposophist, showing reverence and awe in face of world phenomena. It is precisely the more developed souls who will be able to experience ever greater wonder. The less one is able to wonder, the less advanced is the soul in question. It is the case that people express far less wonder at daylight events, toward the everyday phenomena of life, than, for instance, in face of the wondrous starry firmament in all its majesty. Yet higher soul development actually only begins when one is able to wonder as much at the smallest flower, the tiniest leaf, the most unassuming beetle or worm, as the mightiest cosmic processes. It is basically quite strange. People are generally keen to ask for explanations of the things that move them sensationally. People living near volcanoes, for instance, will ask about the causes of volcanic eruptions because they need to pay more attention to such facts than to other everyday events. Even people living far from any volcano seek information because this is both exciting and sensational for them. But when someone has a soul configured such that they enter life being amazed at everything because they sense that their entire surroundings contain a spiritual element, they are no more astounded by a volcano than by the minute bubbles and craters in their milk or their breakfast coffee. They are equally amazed by what is small as by what is large. Approaching everything with wonder is a memory of how we could see before we were born. By approaching all our deeds with our conscience means having the vivid anticipation that every deed we do will appear to us in a different guise in future. People who feel this are predestined, to a greater extent than others, to be drawn to spiritual science. We live at a time when certain things emerge that can only be explained by spiritual science, things which defy other explanation. People behave very differently when confronted with such things. Nowadays we can doubtlessly observe all sorts of human characteristics, yet within the most varied of character nuances, two main types of nature stand out. One of these natures can be seen as pensive, tending toward reflection, able to feel astonishment at everything, and who always feels the stirring of their conscience. All sorts of distress, of gloomy, melancholic moods can settle in such souls under the aegis of an unsatisfied longing for explanation. A sensitive conscience can make life more difficult. Another sort of person is also prevalent today, however. They do not long for any such clarification of the world. For them, every explanation of the world based on spiritual research is frightfully boring. They prefer to launch into things robustly rather than seek explanations. And if one starts to give an account of anything, they will start yawning. It is certainly true that conscience stirs far less in people constituted in this way than it does for those others described earlier. Why is it that such opposites in character manifest? Spiritual science is motivated to explore the causes as to why some can be distinguished by their contemplative nature and their thirst for knowledge, while others set out only to enjoy life without seeking for elucidation. If one investigates the scope of the human soul through spiritual science, and I can only give isolated indications here as it would take many hours to explore this thoroughly, one finds that many of those endowed with a thoughtful nature, who cannot live without making sense of life, had direct soul knowledge in previous lives of the reality of reincarnation. Today there are countless people on earth who know about this and for whom reincarnation is an absolute fact. Just think of Asia and all those people who connect, if not necessarily directly, a contemplation of their present life to another previous existence when they knew about reincarnation. However, the other, more robust, human natures hail from lives when nothing was known about earlier lives on earth. They feel no urge to burden themselves with a conscience in relation to their deeds, nor to bother much about the reasons behind anything. Many people in the Western world are constituted in this way, and it is simply a characteristic of Western culture that people have, as it were, forgotten their previous lives. Yes, they have forgotten them. But we are now at a turning point where memory of past lives will again be revived. This is why people living today face a future which can be outlined as one in which a connection with the spiritual world will be reinstated. Today this only applies to a few people, but during the course of the 20th century, it will be a widespread feature among populations. It will be like this. Let's imagine that someone has done this or that, and afterward their conscience is plaguing them. It is like that now. Later, however, once a spiritual connection has been restored, human beings will feel compelled, after having done something or other, to retreat slightly from their deed, as if with eyes bound shut. A picture similar to a dream image, but quite a vivid dream picture, will arise of the necessary future consequences of their deed. And when they experience this, will think something like this: yes, though I am the one experiencing this, I have not yet experienced what I am now seeing. For all those who have heard nothing of spiritual science, this will be something terrible. On the other hand, those who have prepared themselves for what will face all future humanity will say to themselves, though I have not yet undergone it, in future I will nevertheless know it to be the karmic adjustment for what I have just done. Today we stand as if in the forecourt of times in which karmic compensation will appear prophetically to people, as if in a dream image. Now imagine this experience becoming ever stronger and more compelling over the course of time, and you will see the humanity of the future, who will be able to see how their deeds are karmically rebalanced. By what means will it come about that human beings become capable of seeing this karmic compensation? This is connected with the fact that the human beings of old had no conscience, but instead, following wrongdoing, they were plagued by the Furies. That was ancient clairvoyance, and it has passed. Then there followed a time when the Furies could not be seen. The Middle Ages, when what the Furies used to exact arose inwardly as conscience. Now, we are gradually approaching times when we will again perceive karmic recompense. Having won a conscience, humans will henceforth be enabled to gaze into spiritual worlds. If certain people of an inward nature presently become aware that they had in former lives gained forces which manifest, through wonder, as a memory of those former lives, people of today will also take with them into future incarnations such forces if they today acquire knowledge of spiritual worlds. But those who have balked at absorbing an elaboration of the laws of reincarnation will, by contrast, have an awful time of it in the future world. For such souls, this will be a terrible fact. Today we live in an age where people just about manage to get by in life, even if they have no concept of life as regards spiritual worlds. But this age, condoned, as it were, by cosmic forces, ends such that people who have no connection with the spiritual world will, in their next lives, grow up not understanding the world into which they are born. And when they leave what has become an incomprehensible physical existence at death, they will continue to have no understanding for the spiritual world in which they are to mature. Obviously, they will enter the spiritual world, but they will not be able to grasp it. They will find themselves in a bewildering environment that makes them feel as though they do not belong in it, and which plagues them as only a bad conscience can. When they enter their subsequent incarnation, it will be just as dreadful. They will suffer all manner of urges and passions, and will appear to be living in illusions and hallucinations, because they can evince no wonder or amazement. Today's materialists face a future in which they will be horribly beset by torturous illusions and hallucinations, because what that person thinks in this life will later be experienced as delusions and hallucinations. We can imagine this most intensely. By way of example, let us take two people walking along the road together. One is a materialist, the other a non-materialist. The latter says something about the spiritual world. The other says or thinks, "Oh, that's all nonsense. It's just a load of illusions." Indeed, for this person, it is illusion. But for the one mentioning the spiritual world, it is not illusory. After death, the consequences for the materialist will set in, let alone when they reincarnate. Then it will be the case that they experience spiritual worlds as an excruciating reproach. During their time in Kamaloka between death and rebirth, they will experience no difference between Kamaloka and Devakan. Once reborn and faced with a spiritual world as described, it will seem unreal, illusory, and hallucinatory. Spiritual science is not merely something with which to satisfy our curiosity. We are not gathered here because we are simply more curious than others about the spiritual world. We are here because, to a greater or lesser degree, we sense that the people of tomorrow will not be able to live without spiritual science. All other aspirations that fail to take this into account are heading toward decadence. Now, matters are such that those who today resist being open to spiritual science will in future have the opportunity to approach it during their future embodiments. However, there need to be outposts, people who today, through their karma, have a longing for spiritual science, thus have the opportunity to be such outposts. This opportunity comes toward them because they are forerunners and need to be outposts. Other human beings will see the longing for spiritual science emerging among humanity as a whole, as part of universal human karma. The end of Lecture 4.